Welcome back to the program. My guest, Peter Beinhart, argues that Israel is in danger, not just from outside forces, not just from Palestinians or Iranians, but from the unraveling of its own values, its central ideas, and its founding principles. Peter Beinhart argues that we need to view Israel today not as some Disneyfied version of the Holy Land, but as a modern nation-state with real power that must be merged with the responsibilities of that power and the values that created the nation in the first place. And that perhaps the greatest threat to accomplishing this comes not from Israel's neighbors, but from an American Jewish community that has made power, real estate, and Zionism a religion unto itself. Peter Beinhart is a former editor of the New Republic, a Rhodes Scholar at University College at Oxford. He's currently Associate Professor of Journalism and Political Science at the City University of New York and a senior political writer at the Daily Beast. He's editor of the blog Open Zion, and it is my pleasure to have Peter Beinhart back on this program to talk about his newest book, The Crisis of Zionism. Peter Beinhart, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Delight to have you here. One of the things that seems to be most apparent is there seems to be such a fundamental difference between some of the founding and central values of Israel as a nation versus the attitudes of the current Israeli government.
I'm a Zionist, and for me, what makes the creation of the State of Israel so extraordinary is in 1948 was not just that Jews were given a state as refuge after the Holocaust, so that if anyone tried to slaughter the Jewish people again, there would be a state dedicated to Jewish protection, but also that the founders of that state, in the most difficult circumstances imaginable, with the entire Arab world rallying to destroy the nascent Jewish state, with the stench of Jewish death still hanging over Europe, that Israel's founders, in its Declaration of Independence, pledged a country, a Jewish state that would offer complete equality of social and political rights, irrespective of race, religion, and sex. That's what it says in Israel's Declaration of Independence. My fear is that the occupation of the West Bank, occupying millions of Palestinians who don't have citizenship and the right to vote because they're not Jews, who live under military law, who have their movements radically restricted, is in direct violation of the promise of what Israel was supposed to be, and that we need to find a way of making sure that that occupation does not become permanent, because if it does, then I think it will be very, very difficult for Israel to live in harmony with its own founding principles.
And it certainly does seem that with each day that passes that those settlements do in fact become more permanent, and the demographics are such that they're growing exponentially.
Yes. In fact, there was an interview just yesterday with a woman who really was in charge of the settlements for under Ariel Sharon, the former prime minister, who said that she believed that just a few more years of this particular settlement policy under Benjamin Netanyahu, in which it's not just that Jews are allowed to build in the West Bank, but in fact that they are actually subsidized. In many ways, it's cheaper to build houses and businesses and agricultural enterprises in the West Bank, in what I call non-democratic Israel, than within the so-called green line inside democratic Israel, that eventually it will simply be impossible to evacuate enough of those settlements to create a viable Palestinian state. And I think we need, although there are risks to the creation of a Palestinian state, the alternative is quite clear. The alternative will be the end of Israel as a democratic Jewish state, because Israel will be master of millions of Palestinians who it can either not give citizenship to, which will throw its democratic credentials into question, or if it does give citizenship and the right to vote to them, then it will no longer be a Jewish state.
And with each passing day, the idea of a two-state solution because of these settlements seems to be more and more out of reach.
Yes, and I don't want to exonerate the Palestinians. The Palestinians have made critical mistakes at various points that I think have made a two-state solution harder. And so in my book, I'm quite critical of the way Yasser Arafat responded, for instance, in 2000 and 2001 during the negotiations with Bill Clinton and Ehud Barak. But that being said, all of that becomes much harder. It becomes harder for the Palestinians to compromise. Palestinian radicalism is fueled when Palestinians see their hope of a state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip being eaten away by the inexorable growth of Jewish settlements.
And, of course, the other side of this is what happens if there is not a two-state solution and what a one-state situation looks like.
Yeah, I mean, a one-state situation, in my view, that it does have, the idea does have its proponents, but I think it would be a bloody mess. I don't think that you can realistically make this entire area, which would be about 50% Jewish and 50% Palestinian, into one state that would hold together. I think what you would have would be something like what you had before the British left. You would have essentially a civil war between Jews and Palestinians, which would serve neither community at all. On the other hand, I also think that a one-state reality in which you have a permanent Palestinian non-citizen class numbering in the millions is a recipe for continued revolt and bloodshed of its own. So I think the two-state solution, while it's not perfect, is the best chance to maintain Israel as a democratic Jewish state and give Palestinians the rights and national dignity that they very, very much deserve. And I fear that the American Jewish community is kind of sleepwalking towards the death of the two-state solution. And that's part of the reason I wrote this book.
Part of what a one-state solution looks like is the danger of this apartheid situation.
Yes. You know, if you have millions of Palestinians in the West Bank who don't have citizenship, don't live under the same law as Jews, can't vote, of course, in Israeli elections, have very significant restrictions on their movement, that really is not doesn't live up to the principles of Israel's own founding, and I think it throws Israel's democratic credentials very much into question if that becomes a permanent reality. And I believe, as a Zionist, as someone who believes that Jews deserve a democratic Jewish state, I believe that Zionism can only ultimately succeed if it's a democratic movement, if we can show that the idea of a Jewish state and the idea of a democratic state are compatible, even though there may be some tension between them. If we can't do that, if Zionism becomes an undemocratic project, then I fear it will eventually be the end of Zionism itself.
Talk about why. Talk about the corrosive impact of that if Zionism can't succeed as a democratic movement.
I think what will happen if the possibility of a Palestinian state dies, and I don't think that day is that far off, frankly, then I think what will happen is that gradually over time, the world will turn Israel into more of a pariah state. The world will look at Israel's holding of millions of West Bank Palestinians as non-citizens, denied the rights, the fundamental rights that Jews enjoy. And the world will say, in a post-colonial democratic age, this is unacceptable. And if the two-state solution can no longer offer a way out, I fear that more and more people will demand that Israel transform itself into one ostensibly secular binational state with Israel, including Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. And that would be the end of the Zionist dream.
Talk about the ways in which the American Jewish community is feeding this danger.
I think the American Jewish community is organized to rally around the protection of Israel against external threats. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. There are external threats, and it can be quite useful sometimes for American Jews to alert the American government to help Israel. For instance, the American Jewish community has been involved in helping Israel get the technology for what's called Iron Dome, the anti-missile defense, which shoots down rockets from Gaza and Lebanon, which is terrific. But I think the American Jewish community doesn't have a way of dealing with the idea that Israel could actually face internal threat. There's a strong ethic that says that since we don't live in Israel, we should let the Israelis make whatever decisions they want about their own policies. And while I understand the instinct behind that, and of course we should have humility towards Israel as we do towards any other country, I believe that the best way for us to be pro-Israel is to stand in solidarity with Israel's founding document, its Declaration of Independence, just like the best way for us to be pro-American is for us to try to help America live out the principles of our Constitution and Declaration of Independence. And when you have a government that is promoting policies that are so flagrantly in violation of that founding document, I think we have to find a way of speaking out about that.
And in many ways, the discussion becomes about security and about land, and the whole discussion about rights and ideas gets lost completely.
Yeah, but land does not provide security if what comes with the land is millions of people who live under occupation, hate the occupation, hate their occupiers, i.e. the Israeli government, and whom you can't find a way of giving citizenship to. That doesn't actually provide security. Security is not, in today's age, is not only about land. I believe that at the core of Israel's security are its democratic credentials, that the way Israel's ultimate strength lies in its ability to command the allegiance of the people under whom who live under it. And that actually is imperiled when you hold millions of Palestinians in the West Bank who don't have citizenship and the right to vote and who live under military law, and as a result are guaranteed sooner or later in some form or another to revolt against the Israeli government.
One of the things you talk about early on in the book is kind of this empathy gap that exists. Talk a little bit about that.
I don't think that American Jews in the organized American Jewish world encounter Palestinians very much. If you look at, for instance, the birthright trips, these trips that are taken, where thousands and thousands of young American Jews are now sent to go to Israel, which is terrific. I'm glad young American Jews are sent to go to Israel, but they virtually never interact with Palestinians. American Jewish American synagogues and Jewish community centers and Jewish newspapers virtually never have Palestinian speakers or voices, and I think that's sad, because even though Jews, American Jews and Palestinians might disagree on things, I think it's very important that we have an understanding of the suffering of the Palestinian people. We want, rightly, other people to understand the history of Jewish suffering. And I think that we need to find ways of giving Palestinians a chance to tell their stories to us. Palestinian history has been very tragic. So many Palestinians' families were separated and disconnected during Israel's war of independence. Since then, so many Palestinians have lived in refugee camps or under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And I think that we need to hear those stories, not because we're going to agree on everything politically, but because that empathy, I think, is the basis for a better kind of understanding.
Given that there's been no real negotiation since 2008, 2009, essentially, how do any kind of negotiations at this point, given these attitudes that you've been talking about, how does that get back on track?
Well, the unfortunate thing is that there were actually pretty serious negotiations in late 2008 between then Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas. Olmert himself has actually said that the two sides were quite close and has urged Benjamin Netanyahu to continue those negotiations. Netanyahu has not been willing to pick up where Olmert left off. He does want to negotiate, but the problem is he hasn't been willing to say that he will negotiate along the parameters that Olmert and indeed Ehud Barak as well back 10 years earlier were negotiating along, which was essentially a Palestinian state in the vast majority of the West Bank along the 1967 lines with some land swaps. And as a result, Mahmoud Abbas isn't willing to talk at all. I think that's a mistake. I think the Palestinians should talk to Benjamin Netanyahu. But I can understand their skepticism when Netanyahu so explicitly rejected Barack Obama's calls for negotiations based on the 1967 lines plus swaps. Because if that's not your basis for negotiations, then I don't really think you're discussing a viable, contiguous Palestinian state.
Talking about some of the obstacles that Obama has faced in this, in some ways he came into office wanting to do the right thing, as you talk about, but it hasn't gone very well.
I think, as I write in my book, I think Obama, no president has taken office who was more influenced as an adult by Jews than Barack Obama. So many of his political and legal supporters and mentors and academic supporters and friends in Chicago were Jewish. They were mostly Jews who were progressive politically, many of whom had been involved in the civil rights movement, and who were themselves quite critical of Israel's policy in the West Bank. I think Barack Obama had a vision of what was good for Israel and what was good for America that involved trying to create a Palestinian state and end the occupation. But I think that once he came into office and was confronted with an Israeli government that had a quite different agenda, a Palestinian leadership that was eager, I think, interested in those negotiations, but weak, and an organized American Jewish community that was very strongly opposed to any American pressure on Israel to, for instance, end settlement growth and negotiate along the 1967 lines. Ultimately, he decided the political price was too high.
And, of course, there's the internal politics on the Israeli side as well, internal politics that Netanyahu is facing.
Yes. Netanyahu leads a very right-wing coalition government, and he seems quite happy leading this government, but he may be partly happy because the government gives him an excuse to not do things he really doesn't want to do. I mean, in his government are parties that are to the right of his own Likud, like ultra-Orthodox parties like Shas, small settler parties, the Russian-dominated right-wing party Yisrael Beiteinu, led by Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. And I think Netanyahu has not assembled a political coalition that gives him the political space to negotiate in the kind of expansive way that his predecessor Ehud Olmert did.
And yet, coming back to your first point on that, it does seem that the idea of a two-state solution has always been somewhat antithetical to Netanyahu.
Yes, I think, and I go through this history in some detail in my book. I mean, Netanyahu was very, very explicit for many, many, many years, going back to his entrance into Israeli politics in the late 1980s, that he was very strongly opposed to a Palestinian state, which he believed would imperil Israel's security. In fact, when he was elected in 2009, he was not in support of a Palestinian state. He changed his mind and said publicly in June 2009, under a lot of American pressure, that he would support a Palestinian state. But it's really striking that he has never been willing to say that that Palestinian state would be on the vast, vast majority of the West Bank. And in fact, just as recently as last week, one important minister in Netanyahu's own government said that the two-state solution is not the policy of this Israeli government, that speech in 2009 was given for foreign consumption, and that Netanyahu has made no effort to get his government to, in fact, endorse the idea of a Palestinian state. So I think, unfortunately, I think there is reason to still be somewhat skeptical about whether Benjamin Netanyahu really does support a Palestinian state along the lines that were conceived of, let's say, by his predecessor, Ehud Olmert.
And certainly looking at some of the statements that were made by the foreign minister, by Lieberman, one comes away with an even stronger impression of that.
Yeah, I mean, Lieberman has an interesting view. I mean, Lieberman has actually said he supports a Palestinian state, but he's also said that the condition for a Palestinian state would be that the Palestinian state would have to take some of the Arab citizens who live within Israel's democratic borders, within its 1967 line. So Lieberman has said if there would ever be a Palestinian state, then what we must do is take some of the Arabs who are right now citizens of Israel inside what's called the Green Line, and essentially have their territory be transferred to a Palestinian state, which is vociferously opposed by those Arab Israelis themselves, and I think would raise a lot of really troubling issues.
There is also the issue of power in all of this, and one of the things you talk about is that so much of the Israeli and Jewish ethical traditions come out of this sense of powerlessness, and that it doesn't seem to be playing out the same way operating from a position of power and strength.
The point I try to make is that we American Jews take enormous pride in the Jewish ethical tradition. You know, we say, you know, we've just finished the holiday of Passover, and it says in Exodus that we remember the heart of the stranger since we were strangers in the land of Egypt. And American Jews, I think, have a lot to be proud of in having been at the forefront of many, many movements in the United States for human dignity and equality of opportunity. But if it turns out that this Jewish ethical tradition, which has so inspired us, cannot meaningfully inform the government of a Jewish state, then you have to ask the question, well, how powerful was that ethical tradition after all? If it was only powerful when Jews, if it only had meaning when Jews lacked power, if it only could inform us when we were powerless, and once we got a state, in fact, we didn't live up to the ethical traditions that I think are best represented by Israel's own Declaration of Independence, the promise of equal citizenship, then I think it casts the whole Jewish tradition in a very, very different light. And that's one of the things that really worries me. I really believe that in some sense, Judaism itself is at stake in this question of how Jews wield power after two millennia of powerlessness.
And this is one of the things that, and you've talked about this previously, that is really turning young people off, turning off a whole new generation.
Younger American Jews, I think, are less connected to the State of Israel than their parents and grandparents. Part of the reason is simply assimilation, that they may be less connected to being Jewish in a range of ways. But what's interesting is that even if you look at young people who actually are quite committed and connected to living a Jewish life, they too often show these levels of discontent and alienation from Israeli policy. And I think it's because young people have had a different historical experience. They haven't seen Israel threatened with extinction in the way it was in 1967 or 1973, when Israel was a relatively small and embattled state confronted with Arab armies that were united together and which were much more militarily, seemed much more militarily powerful. They've also never seen Israel as a refuge for the influx of large numbers of Jews who were fleeing anti-Semitic persecution. And what they have seen is Israel occupying the West Bank and Israel as a kind of a regional superpower. So I think for them, our effort to make them feel connected to Israel, to make them Zionists, which I would hope young American Jews would be, I think very much has to do with our ability to engage them in a struggle for Israel's democratic character. For us to say that you are implicated in this project of Jewish statehood, because Judaism itself is at stake here. The good name of Jewish honor is at stake in the question of whether we will act ethically towards the people who we control, given our own history of oppression, and that you should find a way of supporting democratic values in the State of Israel.
Why does this argument meet with such vociferous opposition? Certainly the criticism that you personally have endured from groups in the U.S., from the American Jewish community, has been extreme.
Well, these are very emotional issues for American Jews. I think, first of all, there is a tradition that says that you should keep criticism within the family. You should not air dirty laundry. And I think there's some people see someone like me, an American Jew, publicly criticizing Israeli policy, and they say, this gives aid to our enemies, to those people who hate Israel, maybe hate Jews, don't want Israel to exist at all. I don't see it that way. I believe, actually, that the best way of defeating Israel's enemies, the people who don't want Israel to exist, is, in fact, to strengthen Israel's democratic character. And when we're silent and allow Israel to undermine that character, potentially fatally, then, in fact, we hand anti-Semites or people who are hostile to the State of Israel the best ammunition they could possibly have. So that's a very profound disagreement, and I try as much as possible to maintain a civil discussion with people in the American Jewish community with whom I disagree, because even some of my own friends and family disagree with my point of view, but I think it's important for us to be able to have this conversation.
It's ironic that the debate takes place in Israel, and there isn't that same criticism of some of these ideas that there is in from the American Jewish community here.
Well, you know, Israelis are more uninhibited because they don't have to face the accusation which so often is leveled at those of us in the United States, in the American, who are Jews who criticize Israel, which is to say, well, if you have these issues, why don't you simply go live there? Stop complaining from over here and go and live there. They already do live there, so they are uninhibited in a way that American Jews are. I think that one of the things that alienates younger American Jews is the lack of debate, particularly in the organized American Jewish community. Of course, there are Jews around America who write and say all kinds of things, but in the organized American Jewish community, I think there's often an attempt to say to American Jews, let's not really discuss the hard questions about what's going on in the West Bank. Let's essentially just start with the assumption that what Israel does is right, and we'll help you, give you the reasons to explain why. And I think it's that kind of attitude which runs counter to the Jewish tradition of open debate and of critical, searching inquiry that I think actually alienates a lot of younger American Jews.
And one of the other points you've made is that much of that extreme support within the American Jewish community for the policies of the Israeli government have come from a more secular part of that Jewish community.
Historically, it's been it's been non-Orthodox American Jews who are the large majority who have been the foundation of the American organized Jewish community. I think that's changing somewhat as many of those secular younger American Jews drift away, and that the increasingly the foundation of the Jewish organizational world in the future may come more and more from the ranks of the Orthodox community. I have a lot of sympathy and affection for the Orthodox community, and my own family for many, many years has been members of Orthodox synagogues, but I do think that one of the concerns that we have in the Orthodox community is that sometimes in the Orthodox community there's such a strong devotion to the biblical land of Israel that there's not enough recognition that what makes Israel precious is its democratic character, and so that we need to have that struggle in the Orthodox community to realize that what we love about Israel is not only that it controls biblically important territory, but in fact because that it acts in an ethical way towards all the people under its domain.
Is there anything in the current debate and the current evolvement of policy that gives you any optimism for the situation?
What gives me hope is that there have been Israeli leaders like Ehud Olmert. Mm-hmm. Olmert was on the right. He had also been a member of the Likud, who have come to the realization that holding the West Bank was not in Israel's interest. The fact that he could have that epiphany, I think, gives me hope for other leaders. The other thing that gives me some hope is that I hope that the Palestinians will turn to nonviolent resistance. The Palestinians have undermined their cause so badly over the years by the resort to terrorism and the terrible suicide bombings of the Second Intifada. I think there is some evidence that Palestinians in the West Bank are now more interested in nonviolent protests. And I think the dynamic that will be created if Palestinians organize themselves nonviolently will be so much more constructive for both sides. And so I hope that that's the future for the Palestinian struggle for statehood.
Peter Beinart, his book is The Crisis of Zionism. Peter, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.